Welcome to It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics and practice presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, or NSHEN. I'm Marika Warren, network ethicist for NSHEN, and I'll be your host for this discussion. I'm joined today by returning guest Amanda Porter, who is a healthcare ethicist with Ethics Nova Scotia Health and IWK Health. Along with other members of Ethics Nova Scotia Health's Ethics Education Group, Amanda has worked to put together a guide to support healthcare providers and healthcare teams when questions arise about substitute decision-making, which occurs when a patient can't make their own decisions and someone else has to try and figure out what decision the patient would make for themselves if they had the ability. So perhaps to start at the beginning, Amanda, how did this resource come to be?
So about 3 years ago, we published an FAQ document for substitute decision makers and families about the role of the substitute decision maker. And this is available in electronic or print form in four languages. And some hospital units include this FAQ document in their admission packages. Some keep copies on hand in the unit to help substitute decision makers. This document was called Making Healthcare Decisions for Someone Else. It's a relatively short document, it's written in plain language, and it helps to clarify who the legal SDM is and the nature and scope of the SDM role. So we knew when we were writing this document a few years back that this resource for families would need to be supplemented with a resource for staff that would cover some of the same ground, but also address some of the complexities that arise and that were often present in requests that we were receiving for clinical ethics consultation. So this much longer, more detailed document for physicians and staff is what we just published last week. And we confirmed that there was an appetite for this kind of document in our ethics needs assessment that we conducted just last spring, where substitute decision-making was raised as a recurring ethics issue.
Terrific. And I'll note that we'll link to the document in the show notes for this episode if folks are wondering where to find that. And maybe to sort of further illustrate why this resource was needed, Amanda, could you describe a case or two that raised the sort of challenges that the resource is designed to help address?
There are a wide range of situations where this document might be useful. So, for example, imagine there's a young adult who has a motorcycle accident, they are unconscious, and a decision needs to be made about whether to proceed with a risky surgery that has an uncertain chance of saving their life. So our hope is that this guide would help teams to identify who the legal decision maker would be and the legal and ethical principles that should guide that decision making. Complicating features of this kind of situation might include things like that the accident involved a very unexpected and sudden change, so the SDM might not have had the benefit of the patient's prior expressed preferences. And there might also be lots of clinical uncertainty about whether the patient's life can be saved and also what the quality of their life might be like after recovery that could make determination of best interests more difficult. Another example where this guide might be useful would be imagine you have an adult who has some developmental disabilities and they're admitted to hospital with serious infections and complications related to diabetes. And let's say a decision needs to be made about whether to insert a feeding tube, which they anticipate the patient will resist forcefully. So here there may be some uncertainty about whether an SDM is appropriate at all, or whether the patient is rightly their own decision maker, or could be their own decision maker with some support. So we hope that this guide would be useful in addressing these kinds of questions. If an SDM was determined to be appropriate, then this guide could help teams to recall how that process works, including who the decision maker would be. In a case like this, there might also be uncertainty about whether the harm of force feeding would be worth the benefit of the nutrition that would be provided. So would this short-term gain of nutrition cause long-term distress and avoidance of healthcare in general due to the anticipated use of restraints? So this SDM guide is going to help provide some guidance, but it's not going to answer difficult questions that need to be answered. And some places we've referred readers to other relevant resources that exist, such as the restraints as a last resort policy as well. Another kind of scenario where this might be useful would be, say you have an older adult who's got advanced COPD and they have an advanced directive for palliative and comfort-based approach to care. Let's say this patient decompensates and becomes delirious, and their adult child wants the team to, quote, do everything, end quote. So here, there may be prior expressed preferences, and these are well known and documented, but there is a family member who wants to go against those clear wishes. And so our hope is that this guide could help to empower teams in redirecting the substitute decision maker towards the patient's most recent relevant prior expressed preferences, values, and beliefs. Just a kind of twist on that scenario would be where there's a healthcare team that wants to provide an active intervention that the SDM is refusing. So, for example, the team wants to treat physical pain or an agitated delirium, but the SDM refuses or declines that intervention. And again, our hope is that in this kind of situation, our guide will help to redirect teams and SDMs towards prior expressed preferences of the patient themselves, or where these are unknown, their values and beliefs more generally.
So in terms of, I mean, that's a fairly wide range of scenarios where we might be looking to apply this. So what was some of the thinking around like how the guide can help across situations like these?
The guide includes information to help people understand when a substitute decision maker is required, how that's determined, who the correct substitute decision maker would be, how decisions should be made, both the process and content of decisions, and also explore some areas of conflict or uncertainty. So our hope is that most questions about who the correct decision maker is will be answered through this guide. And we also hope that it will help to give teams some tips or guidance for approaching potential conflicts. But we don't think that this guide will on its own resolve all conflicts or provide a simple and quick remedy where there is an impasse.
Nonetheless, it strikes me this is going to be a really, really useful tool that can be used to support a lot of different teams throughout the healthcare system. But I'm wondering what the process of developing it was like. So how we sort of said, you know, how it came to be, what its origins were, but then how did we go from there to having the completed resource done?
Yeah, we had a small ethics education working group that included several members of the ethics collaborations team from the Department of Bioethics at Dow. It also included a community member who's volunteered with ethics for many years and has a really useful background in communications. We had a graduate student slash researcher, a clinical nurse educator, a psychiatrist, and also we benefited from having a lawyer from the Nova Scotia Health Legal Services. We had one member from professional practice who joined us when it was possible. And with various drafts of this document, we sought wide-ranging feedback via email and electronic surveys. And I think in total we had feedback from about 60 groups or individuals across the province representing different professions and programs.
All right, so that is a lot of folks who've contributed significantly to the resource. And as someone who will likely benefit from that work, I thank all of those individuals for their care and their time. But speaking of time, how long did that all take? It sounds like that was quite a significant amount of work.
It was a lot of work. It took us about 2 years to finish this.
And given all that input that was being given, how did the group decide what to include in the guide? I'm assuming that with all of the feedback you were getting and all the people involved, that there were some different opinions as to what should or should not be included.
Yeah, definitely. And initially, we pulled questions from things that have come up for us in ethics consultation requests and or calls to legal. But we also added some questions in response to the feedback that we did get. And this document is going to need to be reviewed annually, and we welcome additional suggestions for questions that we might add.
So I'm interested with that connection with legal as well. So recognizing that there are certainly legal aspects to a lot of these scenarios, how exactly did you involve legal services? Were they there from the beginning or was it sort of on an as-needed basis?
Legal services was available and part of our working group pretty early on, not from day one, but pretty early on. They joined us as a member of our working group. We met biweekly. And they also gave final approval of the document. You'll see at the top of the document, there's a text box that indicates this is an electronic version, this is a controlled document, and we need to keep it updated as new cases or issues emerge or the law changes.
So if folks who are listening are very excited about this resource and really want to get their hands on it, how can this guide be accessed?
Currently, the guide is available online only. So you can access it on the Library Services page under the Clinical Practice Supports. On Nova Scotia Health's Library Services page, you can just search Substitute Decision Making and it'll come up. And the full title is Working with Patients and Substitute Decision Makers, an Education Guide for Nova Scotia Health Team Members. We encourage people to bookmark this and add it to your favorites for easy retrieval. A link to it is also available on our Ethics Nova Scotia Health Subject Guide on the Library Services page. Healthcare providers can also find it through Compass by going to clinical resources, then finding it in the list of clinical practice guides.
All right, so that hopefully should give folks enough information to find it through a range of strategies. So I'm wondering, you mentioned that this guide will not resolve all of the challenges and questions related to substitute decision making. So I'm wondering if you want to flag just some of the other ways that Ethics Nova Scotia Health supports healthcare teams when they're struggling with these sorts of questions.
There's a variety of ways that we can provide support. One thing that we do is clinical ethics support. This is where there's ethical uncertainty or uneasiness about a particular patient's care. This can happen in person or online, and it might take the form of a one-on-one conversation or a small group discussion or a larger facilitated group discussion. So typically this clinical ethics support occurs while the patient is currently a patient, but sometimes people can request this kind of support after a patient has died or been discharged and there's some lingering ethical uneasiness about something that occurred. And increasingly, we're involving members of the provincial clinical ethics group in these meetings as we endeavor to build capacity for facilitating ethics discussion and doing ethics analysis across the system. We also do in-person or online ethics education of various kinds. And where there might be an organization-wide or policy project related to substitute decision-making, ethics support can be tapped into for feedback on, say, a draft document or involvement on a working group, or to act as a facilitator of an organizational ethics discussion.
Great. So this is not the only way that support is provided, but I think it's a really significant and meaningful one that allows teams to build some capacity in working through these issues when they arise. I think this has been a really useful discussion to have, and I hope folks are inspired to go and check out the guide and, like you say, bookmark it for ease of access the next time these sorts of questions arise. And so to wrap up our conversation, I'm wondering if you can provide a quick summary that highlights why it's sometimes complicated when we're engaged in substitute decision making.
Sometimes substitute decision making is not ethically or really legally challenging. So, for example, the patient might be very obviously lacking in decision making capacity. The SDM is the spouse who is present and engaged at the bedside. The patient had clearly articulated and documented relevant wishes for the scenario. There is no family member questioning the legitimacy, capacity, or appropriateness of the SDM. The proposed intervention imposes minimal risk and extraordinary benefit. And the team and the SDM, they're aligned in the decision to pursue a recommended treatment or a plan of care. But many cases are not so simple, and we hope that this guide can be useful in navigating these real-life complexities. Where there is illness, disease, or injury, there's likely stress, but we hope to reduce or address stress that might be magnified by legal uncertainty or ethical disagreements about substitute decision-making.
Well, thank you so much, Amanda, for sharing your expertise and your reflections. We appreciate your time today, as well as your insight, and certainly all the work that you and others have put into creating this resource. And of course, we also continue to be grateful for production support for this podcast from Lisbeth Whithoff-Newson, Kristen Leshko-Skerry, and the team at Dalhousie MedIT. Thank you to Ben Capps for our theme music, and most of all, thank you for listening. Until next time.